to discuss.
With me now is someone who knows all there is to know about Gustav Mahler, and I'm very delighted in particular to talk to Norman Lebrecht, because for a long time I've been trying to explain to friends of mine why Mahler is so effective. And when I saw a book called Why Mahler, I thought, there's the book for me. And Norman Lebrecht, the man who wrote that book, joins me now. Norman, thanks for coming on the show. Nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure, John.
Norman, I very much enjoyed your book. And what struck me was that you were attempting straight off to engage with this person, Mahler, and the music of Mahler, which is so monumental that it's very hard to put your finger on. And you began somewhere quite early on by saying the best way to approach Mahler is in the present continuous as a man of our own time. Tell me a little about that.
Well, Mahler said, my time will come. And while a lot of us do that and think that we're going to be read in 200 or 300 years from now, he actually meant it. He knew that the music that he was writing and the issues that he was dealing with did not belong to his own time. He said, Richard Strauss, he's the man of our time. Yeah. He's going to have mass popularity and he's going to please the public, and good luck to him. That's not me. I'm dealing with issues that actually lie beyond present cognizance, almost in the same way as Sigmund Freud was. And much about Mahler and Freud is written on the same page, in the sense that both of them operate autobiographically. Each of them takes incidents from his own life and extrapolates them into universal theory. So Freud remembers urinating on the floor of his parents' bedroom when he was 3 years old, and out of that he creates the Oedipus theory. Mahler remembers as a little boy being running away terrified from home above the pub into the woods, deep into the hearts of the forest, and out of that you have the beginning of the First Symphony. Everything he does is drawn from personal experience, and out of that he tries to derive some sort of understanding of the human condition. And the things that he deals with, relationship breakdown, workplace chaos, institutional racism, a multicultural society that won't recognize its multiculturalism, the threat of war, all of these things, they feel very much part of us right now. These are our headlines.
Let's come back to some of those things in just a moment. In fact, all of those things. You also say that the music itself is perfectly pitched for a world constantly adjusting to high-speed developments, many of which carry threat and fear and confusion. And you say the success of the music in these circumstances is that it can mean several things at once.
Yeah.
Now, is that your notion? Or, if you know what I mean, does it actually mean several things at once?
Yes and yes and no is the short answer. You know, in the first place, why Mahler? We're dealing here with a phenomenon that is unique in the history of music. And so to treat him in the same way as you would treat Beethoven or Brahms or Wagner or anyone else is a misnomer. Here is a composer who universally derided in his lifetime, ignored for decades afterwards, returns now to displace Beethoven at the center of our culture. Now, why is that? Why does Mahler feel so much a part of us? What is it that he's giving us in his music that makes us relate to him in both a very personal way and a very public way, that we think that he's somehow providing the soundtrack to our lives and our times? One of the first innovations that Mahler makes in music, and there are many, but one of the first and the most important is the use of irony. Now, irony, as you know, in Samuel Johnson's definition, is the ability to say one thing and mean another, to convey parallel meanings, which is easy in speech because we do it with inflections of the voice, and it's easy in print because we have ways of projecting underlying meanings in the sentences that we write. But nobody had ever tried it before in music. Music, before Mahler, was a linear narrative. Mm. It was a simple thing. Guy got up in the morning and he looked out of the window and the sun's shining and he goes out into the fields and the birds are singing and the cows are mooing, and what's that over there? Oh, that's a nasty great cloud. Oh, it's coming that way. Oh, crash, bang, wallop, there's a storm. I better take shelter. Oh, it's easy now. Oh, the sun's shining, the birds are tweeting. It's a pastoral symphony. Mm. That's what people did before Mahler. They told that kind of story in music. And Mahler, from the very opening phrase of his very, very first symphony, is telling you a whole range of things. In the first symphony, he's talking to you about infant mortality. He takes a nursery rhyme, Frere Jacques, Bruder Martin in German, turns it on its head by putting it in the minor, and gives it a funereal beat, so that you know immediately, in this phrase, he's talking about the death of children. But why would he talk about the death of children in a symphony? Because he's raising a protest against social attitudes to infant mortality, which in the part of the world where he was born was 55%. Mm-hmm. One in two children did not live to lead to see the age of five. And Mahler himself, in his own childhood, saw half of his siblings wiped out by diseases to which nobody was paying attention and which today are curable, but in his time were mortal. So his first symphony, by use of this irony, by use of multi-layering that he does with this particular theme, is telling us something very important about the human condition then and now, about how we relate to the life of the child. One of the key issues today, as we look at society and we look at the viability of life at both ends of life, at the beginning and at the end, who decides at which point life is viable and at which point it isn't? Those questions, if you care to look for them, are all there in Mahler's First Symphony. Now, does he ever express this verbally? No, he doesn't. Firstly, because he is a member of a minority.
Yeah, well, let's just talk about that moment in particular, because this seems to be very crucial to an understanding of Mahler. And to use his own words, he said, "I am three times without a homeland, as a Bohemian in Austria, an Austrian among Germans, and as a Jew throughout the world." Mm. That wasn't an easy start in life for anybody.
No, and he is the first Jewish composer of any consequence to achieve success in Christian Europe. He does so with an awareness of who he is and where he comes from. He knows that his family, although they've lived for hundreds of years in the very epicenter of Europe, if you took a map of Europe, closed your eyes and stuck a pin in it, more likely than not, you'll hit Mahler's birthplace. That's where he's from. And in all of that time, his people never had residence rights. They could have been chucked out of where they were at a moment's notice, dispossessed, told to clear out, and indeed were. One of the first questions that I asked myself, Mahler is born in a little village called Kalistein, Czech, which means muddy ditch. And at the age of 3 months, his parents upsticks, close the little bar that they were running, and move to a town where they know nobody. Why did they do that? Why would you take a little child, you've just had a baby, and you give up everything that you've got and you move into the town? Why, unless somebody's putting a gun at your back, would you do that? Or unless it brings you some enormous other benefit? And the benefit that it brought them was freedom. Up until that time, Jews had not been allowed to live in garrison towns like Iglau, which was the town where Mahler grew up. The moment that ordinance was removed, the moment they had that first glimmering of freedom, Mahler was able to shake off the oppression of ages. His family was able to shake off that oppression, and he was able to begin a life almost as a proper citizen of Europe.
Now, his professional life, though, Norman, took him to Vienna. Mm. And Vienna, at that time, was an appallingly racist place.
Absolutely. I mean, he was pursued by anti-Semitism right the way through his life. Anything that he did wrong, and often many of the things that he did right, he was abused for, not because of what he did and how he did it, but because of his origin, because he was a Jew.
And what about his conversion to Catholicism, then? Do you really buy that?
Not at all, no. And he made it quite clear that it was purely an act of convenience. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was still the Holy Roman Empire, and to have any position, any senior position at the court opera, you had to be a member of the court religion, which was Catholicism. So in order to achieve anything in his profession, he had to convert. He said, "I have a sympathy for the Roman Catholic faith. As a boy, I sang in synagogue and I sang in church. I like that, but I don't like it that they're forcing it down my throat." And so when he did actually convert, he came out of the church, the little St. Michael's Church in Hamburg, and he bumped into an acquaintance on the steps, and the acquaintance said, "What are you doing in there?" And Mahler said, "I've changed my shirt. It's just It was purely a formality, an act of convenience in order to get him the job. He didn't belong to any particular religion. He didn't belong to the Jewish religion. He didn't belong to the Catholic religion. The best way to describe Mahler is the way that the people who were closest to him did. Bruno Walter, for one, the great conductor, who said he was a God seeker. He was forever looking for the relationship of the individual with the creator, and he was completely non-sectarian about it, non-judgmental and non-discriminatory.
And if anybody has any doubts about the seriousness of that situation in Europe, there's a moment in the book, and I've come across this before in other places where it's been imagined, an event which actually happened. 1906, Mahler's conducting Wagner. There's a teenager in the audience, Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
Shocking,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It is chilling, isn't it?
Absolutely chilling. Now, that Jewish background, and this is something that the great Uri Kane has brought out in his wonderful recordings of Mahler's music. That Jewish music, klezmer music, etc., it's all in there. I don't know if it was called klezmer in those days, but that Jewish music is all in Mahler's music.
It is. And there are various other... the form of irony that Mahler uses is also... it's an irony derived from the Yiddish language, which is not the Johnsonian irony that I was referring to, but a way of communication that is developed by people under oppression. And people in Ireland will know what that means, because under British rule, Irish people talked to each other in a different way from the way that they would have talked to British soldiers or British policemen. It's that kind of internal communication that Mahler develops within his music, in which he can convey things that are both said and yet left unsaid because they are understood. And klezmer is one of the devices that he uses to illustrate that, chiefly in the First Symphony, although there's a really interesting klezmer phrase that comes up in the Fifth just before the Adagietto, which I only spotted it the other day. one keeps finding out more things about Mahler.
That's true about that. I mean, it's so vast that you do actually find new things in it every day. Now, in terms of Mahler's relationship with other composers, Debussy called him Mahler, as in misery. Strauss, who you mentioned earlier, didn't like the Adagietto that everybody loves. He said the Fifth was slightly dimmed by it. but what's interesting, I think, is that the people like Alban Berg and Schoenberg and all these people who came afterwards that were seen as completely out there, completely radical, that nobody could understand, they all loved Mahler.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So where are the connections there? Where are the break-off points, do you think?
It's a really... interesting and complex, in the way that almost everything about Mahler is interesting and complex. There are those who see him very much as a classical romantic composer working within the genre of Brahms and Bruckner, both of whom he knew and both of whom he admired. Well, yes, he is. He does. He uses some of those structures and he uses some of that language. But as he's doing it, he's also subverting it. He's breaking it down. He's bringing it to the point of disintegration. And one of the most fascinating aspects of Mahler's life is the relationship with Arnold Schoenberg, who is a bluff, young, bald, rather unpleasant man who nobody in Vienna wants to know. And Mahler, he's the boss. He's head of the opera. He is absolutely the most powerful man in musical Vienna, and he takes Schoenberg under his wing, and he says, I don't quite understand what he's doing, but maybe he's right, and we ought to give him the chance to express himself. He supported him in all sorts of ways, including, secretly, financial support. He would find ways of slipping him sums of money, because otherwise Schoenberg didn't have bread to put on the table for his family. And Schoenberg, who had started out by rejecting Mahler as one of those old-timers, one of those Brahms and Bruckners, starts reading the music and listening to it with different ears. Mm. And at a certain point, Mahler writes his Seventh Symphony and nobody gets it. Even the people who are most sympathetic towards him, Bruno Walter, who I mentioned earlier, Guido Adler, the great musicologist, people who would walk through fire for Mahler, they all said to him, you know, that Seventh Symphony, you really should have left it in the drawer. And Arnold Schoenberg hears it. And he writes to Mahler, I am now utterly and completely yours. And it's quite mystifying, because the Seventh Symphony, when you listen to it, seems to be really not at all modern language. But then you look at the way that Schoenberg develops from that time on, how much of the Seventh Symphony he then uses in his own work. He uses Mahler's scheme of five movements. He uses things like mandolin and guitar, these extraneous instruments that Mahler brought in, apparently for no obvious purpose, but clearly for a purpose of further shaking and disrupting the old order, which Schoenberg was then able to drive
forward. Referred to him as a saint, didn't he? As a martyr.
Yes, he did.
And Alban Berg kept a piece of his toilet paper.
from we don't know whether it was used or not, but he did keep it.
From the place you described in the book as the Earth Closet.
Yes.
Was that what it was called? Something where Mahler wrote, and I think it was called the Earth Closet or something
the
like
Earth
that.
The Earth Closet, yes. Yes.
Now, a lot of the information about Mahler, of course, comes from Alma, the wife.
Mm.
Not to be trusted.
Well,
as a wife or as a biographer.
Indeed,
yeah.
indeed. Who was Mary McCarthy said of another American writer, every word she ever said was a lie, including and but. With Alma, I don't think there is a single word of hers that you can accept without corroboration. She presented a falsification of her life and of the lives around her. She was very keen on being seen by posterity as a muse, as somebody who inspired great men to write works of genius. But she very often falsified the truth, and in the case of Mahler, she was so beset by conflicting feelings towards him that things got tormented and twisted in the telling. It's a wonderful read. I mean, I think I probably came across Mahler through reading Alma and being excited more than anything by her ambivalence about him. You know, a woman who could feel so torn about a man that she was married to at a formative period of her life, well, that man has got to be a pretty interesting character, and the music has got to be interesting as well.
But the misery that she put him through, though, and her affairs and so on, that definitely fed into his music, though. So she was a muse in that negative sense, I suppose.
It did. She was formative. She was formative in two ways. The saving grace with Alma is that she never lied to her diary. And if you care to go to Philadelphia and get into the Van Pelt archives and go through those diaries in her terrible scrawl, you will find something approximating to the truth. So I've had to dig, and others have had to dig really very deep in order to try and find the objective truth about Mahler from Alma. But she was formative to him in two ways. Firstly, she was half his age. He was 41 when he married her, and she was 22, so she introduced him to an entirely new generation, including the generation of Schoenberg and his brother-in-law, Alexander Zemlinsky, who was her lover before she married Mahler. So she rejuvenated him that way. She also introduced him to the visual arts, which had been a block for Mahler beforehand. He'd never understood visual art, and now, because she was the daughter of an artist and the stepdaughter of an artist, Mahler was able to completely turn around his practice at the Vienna Opera and give the visual equal status to the oral, actually appointing an artist, Alfred Roller, to be his co-equal as director of productions. And that was one of the most fruitful things that Mahler did at the opera. It also marked the birth of opera staging as we know it today, the collaboration of all the art forms in the production of a work of art. So she was tremendously important. And then, of course, she betrayed him. Then she took a lover and she brought him to the greatest grief and fear in his life. He had a heart condition. He knew that it could blow at any time and he could die. And he had a terror of dying alone. He had a terror that she would leave him with the child and he would be left there to die alone. And those terrors are heard at their most powerful in the 10th Symphony.
Norman Lebrecht, thank you very much for talking to us today.